group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Cassidy, and I'm an alcoholic. Cassidy! Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers and the main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Aaron R.
Thank you. I ripped the Band-Aid off. Okay. Hi. My name is Aaron, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to speak. Of course, she's my sponsor, so I knew this was coming eventually, but my ego has me holding out for the long talk, and she asked me to do 10 minutes, and at first I was like, oh, God, no, and then I was like, wait, why am I not doing the long talk? And then I saw the real speaker, and I tried to trip him coming down the aisle. That's how I roll, right? That's my alcoholism. Let's get rid of him. I'm really grateful to be here, grateful to talk to my home group in this new space after this long couple of years. Just being around people, being around you is really nice. You know, the Zoom was, it was good for what it was, but there's nothing like being in the middle of the group in the flesh. So I am an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. My date is February. What date is it? February 13th of 2010. Yeah, here we are. Never again 2010. I think that's what it is. But so I had not a traditional childhood growing up. I was born into an ashram community. My parents were hippies, and my dad ended up getting kicked out of the ashram for grilling porter houses on the roof and drinking red wine. That wasn't really what you're supposed to do. But my mom left and took me with her, and we traveled a lot. We went overseas. We lived in Micronesia and the islands. I was running around barefoot. My first real substance that I took into my body was this nut. It was called betel nut. You cut it in half. You put a little cocoa powder on it, wrapped it in a leaf, stuck it in your gums and chewed on it, and you spit it out, got a nice little high. I think actually took the top of a cigarette butt, put the tobacco on there, and chewed that too. And I was zinging around this island at 9 years old, no supervision. It was not fun. I mean, I did what I had to do. I learned how to fight. I was the only white kid on the island, so you kind of had to make your way in a Seventh-day Adventist missionary school. I got home, and I moved in with my dad while my mom reestablished herself in San Diego, and I was pretty young. I started just taking some tokes of pot and my dad's pipe in the basement, and I think I was so young that me and my friends would, like, huddle around his pipe and try to, like, you know, get it to look like how he left it, so we'd have to keep putting more and more in and burning it. That's not how it looked. And then finally, like, we'd just hide the pipe because all the pot would be gone, and we'd be sitting at the counter and you know, Lucky Charms. When he got home, he's like, where is my pot, Aaron? And I'm like, I don't want you doing drugs, Dad.
That happened a few times.
I didn't have a good experience, though, growing up in that house. They were still into this, like, new age sort of lifestyle, him and my stepmom. So
You know, I got really sick. I got rheumatic fever when I was 12, and I lost control of my right arm, had astigmatism in my brain. I hadn't been to the same school for more than 2 years, so I was always the new kid. And then I moved back to San Diego, and I had this, like, thing with my arm, and it wouldn't stop moving like this, right? It was, like, serious, like, this happened. And then, like, they had to strap it to my chest. They slung it around, and so it was just, like, going like that. And I was at a new school, and then they're like, who wants to write for Aaron today? Because it was my right arm. And I was like 12 years old. I needed a drink. So I made friends. We went to the drugstore, got a bottle of Southern Comfort, sat in the parking lot, and drank it. And I did little sips of beers up until that point from my grandparents, but I just, like, woke up in the basement of some guy's house throwing up in a trash bag, and that's how I drank from, like, the get. And I drank like that as much and as often as I could throughout high school. Ended up leaving high school early. Well, I got kicked out of my house. I stayed in high school, but I was an emancipated minor, and just out of spite, I stayed in high school. I graduated and ended up getting a scholarship to school for volleyball. Those of you who go to the Yard know how I feel about volleyball. And I always identify with Cindy Coleman when she talks about her experience at the Yard with the other players on the court. I'm like, get up, you know, suck it up, put the dollar in there and come back. I don't know. That's just how I rolled. I started drinking young and had problems young, and still tried to maintain, like, this outside image just to, you know, prove everyone in my life wrong. And after college, I ended up moving back to Los Angeles. I started to spiral the drain here, because if you want to spiral the drain in your alcoholism and your addiction, LA will take you down. And that's sort of where I hit all of my serious bottoms. You know, I lost everything. I was sort of just living in my car. I had a place to live, but I couldn't really go home there because someone else was paying my rent and it was a little uncomfortable and they were criticizing my drinking. I'd gotten rid of everyone in my life that was criticizing my drinking. And I went on a bender. I said I was going to quit on January 1st. This was like 2001, I think. And I ended up, like, in a blackout for 8 days in Brotman with tubes down my throat, having my stomach pumped. And then my family showed up and was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I don't know. I was just having fun. And I ended up in treatment for the first time in San Diego. And actually heard the first bit of AA through an H&I panel that came in to the treatment center. It kind of resembled these guys that in my head, in hindsight, I think look like Charlie and Bob, like those guys, you know, the Big Book guys, what are their names? Anyways, they do the Big Book Thumper guys. I identified with these two old guys that came into this hospital, and I found myself for the first time through all of the stuff I had been through. I was like, oh my God, that is my problem. So I stayed in treatment. I finished 12 days of detox. It was pretty gnarly. I had DTs. I was 27 years old. I hadn't gone a day without drinking for many, many years. And I'm a real alcoholic. So there was other stuff in my story, but that's like, that was the thing. So I ended up in treatment and ended up in these rooms for the first time on the west side of Los Angeles. And that was always fun to try to, like, you know, be in the hip, slip, cool scene of LA recovery. Definitely a lot of attraction there, to all the big meetings. I met him. We got engaged, pregnant, and married in that order. And then 3 kids later, I was in a deep relapse on pain medications. And I can't really get into that right now, and it's an outside issue, but I really didn't drink too much, but I spiraled the drain for about 5 years, and ended up, after my 3rd son was born, a year later on his birthday, back in detox again, with the worst withdrawals I've ever had to experience in my life. I had checked into detox on about 225 micrograms of fentanyl that were strapped to my body with a heating pad, and I was chewing on a 75 and just trying to get that last little bit out. And I was 110 pounds, and I hadn't left the house for months. And I talk about this in seriousness, but I call it my
Elvis moment, and I was like, you know, sort of like sitting on the toilet at 3 o'clock in the morning and couldn't stay awake and couldn't go to sleep, and had this flash of myself on the bathroom floor and my sons finding me like that, and they were all under the age of 5, and I wasn't being a mother, I wasn't doing anything, we didn't have electricity, the cord was strung out the patio and into the laundry room, and everything was plugged into it, and life was small. And I went through these withdrawals, this detox, and I came out early because I had to get back to my kids. And I ended up, I left detox on a Thursday, and I ended up Friday night at the Pacific Group Women's Stag. And that was, wait a minute, is that 1 minute? Okay, good, because I don't have my glasses on. 1 minute? Okay, perfect. Great. Okay, so I was at the Women's Stag, and those of you from the Stag know me. I had a few meltdowns. Vivian, who read the, she was there. Oh, yeah, so that was fun. I was a mess, and the, you guys put me back together. I went to women's meetings my first year. Yuko's meeting here saved my life. I brought all my kids to this meeting, and I'll be forever grateful for the women in the group that supported me and gave me childcare and helped me. And then I moved completely into Pacific Group that a year. I met Harvey out of a resentment for a women's meeting in Brentwood, and he told me to start coming here. And I started coming to you guys. Got Yvonne as my sponsor, went to the yard. Love Yvonne, but moved to Mary. Mary has changed my life exponentially. She has truly transformed the direction of my life. I ended up back in school. I became the PTA president. My kids and I have an amazing relationship. And even though that marriage didn't work out, we co-parent, and we're able to support our kids through the tools we learn in the program, and I'm able to be in a healthy relationship with a member of this group who I'm not going to talk about because he didn't mention me in his talk, so whatever. All right, so with that being said, it's time to stop. So thank you so much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is P.F.
Thank you. My name is Pete. I'm an alcoholic. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to do this. I have a sobriety date of November 16th, 1991, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at the young age of 19. And I am, AA has saved my life. It's given me a purpose that's shown me what my problem is. I had no idea, absolutely no idea. Beautiful talk, Aaron. I totally identified with a lot of your feelings and that not feeling, you know, you needed a drink at 12, so did I. You know, I actually took my first drink at age 13. Dr. Silkworth, in his opinion, talks about being restless, irritable, and discontent. Man, that is, it was, and can still be me. That's my condition. That's the condition I have. And I always felt that way. You know, like I didn't belong. I didn't, you know, I come from this big, wild Jewish family from the East Coast. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. I'm new to L.A., and I'm loving being here and getting to know you. And I just never felt like my sister was the smart one. She was the gifted and talented one. She was the one that was the oncologist in training. Actually, Yvonne, I went to elementary school with her, actually all through high school in Virginia. And we have, there's a picture in one of our yearbooks where we're sitting right next to each other. And she's kind of got that grimace, and I've got this little smile, and it's like there are two alcoholics in training right there. We were very much so, and our paths were a little bit different, but I tell you what, I took that first drink when I was 13, and then the symptoms of alcoholism were on. The game was on when I was 16. By that point, I just had that anxious apartness. I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. I don't know if anybody can relate with that. Anybody that's new, anybody out on the Zoom world, hello everybody out there. Just not like feeling like I didn't belong. And you know, like I was always afraid that I was not good enough. That I, you know, that fear, that, and that fear, by the way, you know, that can still be with me. I had no idea that that was the problem and that alcohol was going to be a solution for that, that it was going to take care and it was going to take care of that pit in the gut that I always had. Because by that time, I thought my family was the problem. My religion was the problem. Then I started vandalizing property. I started breaking windows. I started doing anything to get attention. You know, people would say, Pete, do this. I would do that. And, you know, break this window, I break this window. Yell this, and I would do it, anything. Anyways, I was 16 years old, and I went on a blind homecoming dance. And some people may have heard this story. It's one of those crazy stories where I had my first blackout. I took my first morning drink. This date went awry. I started drinking right before this dance, and this craving kicked in, this allergy. I wanted to drink more. I'm sitting there, and we're eating steak, and the steak is flying all over the plate. And before I know it, the dance was over, and I couldn't wait to get away from her and back to my buddy's house. By this time, I wasn't. My parents didn't trust me. We were fighting and screaming all the time. The very tense home. Long story short is I started drinking again, and I started drinking boom, 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 boom. You know, if anybody can relate with that, fast and furious. What happened next was my buddy Tom, who was right here, he ends up, going to sleep, so he thought. I'm in his house, and I start to throw up in a sink. I start to scream at the neighbors, and then next thing you know, he throws me into his room. And in the middle of the night, I had a blackout, and I went to the bathroom all over the rug. But I did a number two. It was a poop job, and for the poop sheet, and I did it, and I stepped in it, and it was all over the place. And I had absolutely no idea that. I woke up with the four, the 151 talks about the four horsemen, and I was like, man, there it was. fear, bewilderment, terror, and despair. I took a morning drink, and the solution to that episode was to tell his mom, who was right next door, and the grandma, who was right next door to that the cat did it. And lo and behold, that's exactly what we did. However, when they were pulling all the furniture out of the house, and I was viciously hungover, and that morning drink, I wanted to throw up, I had this weird feeling that, oh my God, this will never happen again. It'll never happen again. And that, I didn't know, it was the cycle I was in, that I will not be able, and it did happen again. It happened again on an Amtrak train from Chicago to Washington. I have a lot of amends. I had to make amends. I was 17 years sober when I cleaned that mess up. I actually rode to Amtrak and told them I was wrong, and they said, take a ride, and I ended up with, I ended up cleaning one of their bathrooms. I had to make amends to Tom. And one of the coolest things that happened is when I was 8 years sober, I had a guy that came up, I was living in Bozeman, Montana at the time. And really, in Bozeman is where I met an enthusiastic group, obviously like this, smaller, but like this, that helped me see what my problem was. And I got a sponsor and all that stuff. And I'll get to that in a second. But I was 8 years sober, and there was a guy who called me up blind on the phone. I didn't know who he was. And he goes, he was living in Memphis, Tennessee. One of my buddies had moved there. He goes, Pete, you don't know me, but I heard that you have this experience of pooping on somebody's rug. I did the same thing. Can you help me with this? Sure enough, I did. And that was part of making amends. And that story, I share that stuff. Anybody else has done something like that? Nothing goes wasted here. Nothing goes wasted here. I'm happy to help. Anyways, clean stuff. I have a lot of amends stories like that. Not just that stuff, but I mean, I drank for 3 years and 3 months. I was a mess. I used to think that that's not, how can I be an alcoholic with 3 years and 3 months? But I come to find out when I was 2.5 years sober, I sobered up at 19 after a DUI. I came in 1991, through the court system. I was in Pennsylvania. And I made a beginning in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't believe deep down, I had not surrendered that I was really an alcoholic when I didn't realize that my problem is sobriety. And that left to my own devices, if I don't have a spiritual solution, if I don't take different actions, that person will drink again no matter what. And I also didn't realize this, that self-knowledge is not going to fix this. I need to have a spiritual experience. And I didn't want to do any of that. And I was running and I left and I was a sports writer in training and I was going to school and I left all that. I gave that away. Or, you know, I couldn't do it. My grades actually got worse in early sobriety. I had no idea that that was going to happen. So that shows me that alcohol isn't the problem. It was my solution. You take booze away from me. I need something strong. I need a sufficient substitute. I need you guys. I need the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really ran into that when I moved to Bozeman. They helped me see what the problem was. I got a sponsor, and he read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. He read it, and he turned the statements into questions. This is just the method that I've found, and I sponsor guys this way. And I really started to identify with that doctor's opinion. That's me. I identified with not being able to remember with sufficient force the pain. You know, if you guys can relate to getting struck drunk, boom. What happened? I didn't want to get drunk, and then there it is. You know, and that's happened quite a few times, even in that short time that I drank, and that no matter what, my mind isn't going to be my friend. Anyways, when I ran into that group, and it was a group where it was in the Clancy sponsorship line, and a guy by the name of Dom P was up there in Bozeman, Dom Pritz, and I heard him, and it was attraction. I ended up moving to Bozeman, Montana, and I stayed there for 13 years, and I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous there. I worked the steps. I ended up doing an inventory, and one of the things that I didn't realize is that I was driven by all that fear, and I was driven by all those resentments. And my life started to change. The amends are a critical process. I had to make those amends to that. I had to make amends. One lady told me when I went back to Penn State, she said, Pete, your mission to make it right to me, because I vandalized her dorm room, your mission is to help others make amends. And one of the most beautiful things was today, one of my sponsees was working on the ninth step. So every time I'm helping, working with others, I am making it right. I've realized, and I know I don't have a whole lot more time here, is that if my primary purpose shifts to me, and I have experience with this, I have made a lot of mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are times where my primary purpose became my career. I need to be a sports writer and get this back. I need to become a good graduate student. And I was living in Asia for a good while before the pandemic hit. And what I didn't realize is that I had drifted away from the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this pandemic has absolutely saved me. I got active again. I got a new sponsor. I went through the steps again. I ended up meeting Sharon. I ended up moving here. I mean, there's been so much more sponsees. And I look forward to what the next adventure is going to be. I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you very much.
Our main speaker tonight is Charles C.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Mary for inviting me to participate here, and thank my friend Barbara for coming with me. And, well, here we are. I had my Elvis moment this evening, Aaron. Sorry, Brian. I had my Elvis moment this evening. I tried to put my pants on after 2 years of being out of them, and it was quite an experience too. And you try to button your collar button with a shoehorn. That usually helps. Kind of push that bag of flesh up in there and hold it. So. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I have no outside issues, so don't worry about that. I got sober on the 11th of June of 1981. They're lurking. That's a saddest group of terrorists I've ever seen in my life. I got sober on the 11th of June of 1981. I have a sponsor named Bob R., who is in Turks and Caicos right now and with his wife. And hello to the Zoom people. And that's that. So I thanked everybody. And there's not much left to tell. I'm alcoholic. I didn't want to be. And I want to thank Pete and Aaron for their talks. I relate completely, except... I was going to say, I want to thank Pete for his enthusiastic talk. He must be pooped. But I'm sort of a contrarian when it comes to certain things. I don't want to relate. I don't like people. I mean them as a species. I don't mean you, but you know who they are. They're out there, and I just don't like them. I think that they're miserable, sorry, ferret-faced little bastards for the most part. The problem I have with people, which is probably not uncommon in here, is while I can't stand the human race, I demand its approval all the time. And it creates this emotional slinky that just keeps going back and forth, and nothing ever gets resolved. It's either one side or the other. And it makes me just not to want to be around people, because I get really testy. I've told the story it was an old story, but I was at work one day, and I got in line, and I was running late, and I got in line to get a muffin and a cup of coffee in the coffee shop in the foyer of the building. And I was standing in line, and I'm behind this lady, and I'm in line for maybe 8 minutes, and then we finally get up. She gets up to the counter, and the guy says, "What would you like?" And she goes, "Oh, I don't know. I had a muffin here a couple of weeks ago. It was really great." I'm thinking, we've been in line for 8 minutes. There's only 4 selections on that menu above his head. And now we get her reminiscing about a muffin, and I'm losing it, and she's... You know, it was, I think it might have been blueberry, but, you know, and just waiting for her to make it. I said, I didn't say it, but I felt it. It's a muffin. Say you pick the absolute wrong muffin. How bad could it be, really, over the end of your life? How much of that would be the impact point for you? Just pick a muffin. It's not a college for your daughter. Pick a muffin, get your coffee, and get the hell out of here, because there are people in line waiting to order who would like to get some coffee. She turned around and she looked at there were like 6 of us behind her, and she said, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't know I was taking so long." And I said, "That's okay." I didn't need a drink when I was 12 years old. I needed a hand grenade. And when I couldn't get a hand grenade for the following 6 years, I needed a drink at that point. And I went through my life with that slinky going all the time. And I was told I had potential by people who had no business telling other people what their potential was, as far as I could see it. So I get pulled into offices. You know, Charles has a lot of potential. My dad was a farmer. He grew up in a farm in Minnesota. My mom was a housewife, and he worked as a carpenter for years and years. And here they are. Neither of them been to college or even have graduated high school. And now we're sitting in a high school counselor's office being told, as we have been told by the priest, as we have been told by somebody else, the teachers, you know, that stuff. Charles has a lot of potential. We don't understand why he doesn't do anything about it. And my reaction was always the same, and that was, I know I've got potential. Clearly, you know I've got potential. Now my parents know I've got potential. Thank you very much. And I will use my potential when I'm goddamn good and ready to use it, and not even that much sooner, because I'm not your pet poodle and I'm not going to be jumping through the hoop for you just because you want me to perform. When I do use it, I hope you've got sunglasses on, Skipper, because I'm going to light you up. And until then, you might want to take your concern from my potential and go wipe it on some other pathetic sap, because if you were such hot stuff, you wouldn't be a high school counselor, would you? it never came out in exactly those words. I usually said something like, I'll try harder. But I've always been a rebel. I'm a secret rebel, though. I'm California's best-kept secret rebel, really. I'm a rebel, but I just don't tell anybody, you know? And there are some of you in here who told people you were rebels, and you're the ones who did time. Same thing, just different approach, you know? But anyway, when I got out of high school with my potential flag flying at graduation, I went into the music industry at 17. I was a clerk in a record store in Fullerton, and I was working in there, and a couple of guys came in who were the hoodlums at my school and asked me if I wanted to go to a party, you know. And I'm not a party guy, because I understand there'll be people at the party, and what point would there be to go if there's people there? And I said, okay. And I went to the party the following week. My best buddy and I, he drove, and we went to this party, and I'm standing in there for 5 minutes and thinking, I made a huge mistake coming to this thing. There were all these kids, and people were, half the room was drunk, and half the room was on acid. It's 1968 in November, and there are a couple of things going on in the world, I wanted to leave, but you can't leave after 5 minutes when somebody else drove. So I stood there grinding on these miserable excuses for human beings with their phony little philosophy 101 bullshit hippie crap. And someone walked up and handed me a can of malt liquor. Just, you know, it's the people's beer, apparently. And it just handed it to me, and it was in a long can. And I started to drink this can of malt liquor because I knew I wasn't going to get offered a soft drink in this crowd. And I'm drinking this thing, and halfway through that can of malt liquor, it occurred to me that I've been way too hard on you people. I began to feel, well, put it this way. The first time I got drunk, I didn't become sloppy or foolish. I became legend. When I drank. And I mean, I hit it out of the park the first time. I was focused and alive and conversational, and I liked you, and you were fascinating. And I felt like a man for a change. You know, I felt like, you know, okay, ladies, my eyes are up here. And that kind of attraction for people, it wasn't true, but it felt that way. And I felt like just percolating with possibilities. And the trouble with achieving legend the first time you drink is sustaining legend over a decade. And that was where the problem was. But I drank for the rest of the evening there. I got drunk. I went into a blackout. I came out of the blackout holding on to my friend's door handle on his Volkswagen as he was trying to drive away, and running alongside the car and throwing up on myself and laughing my ass off because I had broken the tape. I found the mountaintop, you know. I felt alive. And the problem, you'd think that would be a good thing, you know. I mean, I thought about this a lot when I was new, when I heard people talk about alcohol as a problem. And I go, but it wasn't always a problem. It was really good. It gave me the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do a damn thing. How good is that? The big book says that when we drink, we're like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. When I drank, I was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Rogers. I just came alive when I drank. I was happy when I drank. I'm the guy who calls his doctor at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon drunk just to tell him that he's been the best friend a guy could ever ask for, you know, that kind of thing. And I've done that. And I've called, you know, I remembered that when I heard a guy when I was new talk about calling the White House. I think his name was Carlin, and Carlin called the White House like 15 times, so finally they just had him on just quick reference to the security office, you know. But, yeah, you make phone calls. You do really... You know, there's some things that you can talk about in AA that are funny, and then there are some things that you talk about that are shameful. And not shameful necessarily to yourself, but have affected other people in a shameful way. And that's, in a nutshell, how my life went. I have a really boring drunkalogue. I've never come out of a blackout yelling, call for backup. You know, I've never had that experience. I've heard people do that. Guys, I came out of a blackout yelling, cover me, I'm going in. And I thought, you know, that's why I used to come back to meetings, just to hear those stories. They were great. But it wasn't my story. I never said anything coming out of a blackout. Most people who saw me coming out of a blackout would say things like, boy, I bet that hurt. Because I have an unfortunate injury problem when I drink, but you know, it's never anything so serious where you have to go to the hospital. Just, you know, it's like Aaron said, get up and shake it off, you know, come on, what's wrong with you? And I would do that. And my parents lost track of me, and they didn't lose track of me, they lost hope for me after a certain amount of time. And I got married, and she was a wonderful person, a wonderful woman. And it's hard, I'm sure, for people to be married to someone like me, who, you know, I live with these expectations of life that are never fulfilled. And I always wind up, you know, like some of us, We hope we're getting Audrey Hepburn, but usually we're getting, you know, Darlene from Ozark as a partner. But it becomes Darlene at a certain point. You know, all of a sudden things start getting kind of weird and dangerous. But that must have been how she felt too, because she after a while, after 5 years, she didn't want to stay married, and it broke my heart, and I kept drinking, and I wound up peeing blood on a regular basis. I wound up being sick and going to the emergency room on a regular basis, but never to stay overnight, so I didn't have to answer that question yes on a card. And just dying by degree. Now, I don't even want to say dying. It was just a pathetic disintegration of a human being. Not all of us come in here and have a grand explosion of failure and arrests and beatings and all that stuff. Some of us just crawl in here. I think most of us just crawl in here. And most of us crawl in here not beaten up necessarily, but suffering. Suffering from being bewildered by the fact that my whole life is falling apart. I don't know what to do. I keep drinking, which is the only comfort I get, and I can't stop drinking. I can stop all kinds of things. I can stop work. I can stop going over to people's houses. I can stop going out of the house. Pandemic? No problem, you know? That was great for 2 years. Now people are talking about coming out again. I don't know if I want to do that. But I had a moment of clarity at a meditation retreat I went to. I was in therapy for a while. Didn't go particularly well. If therapy's good, I got to tell you, therapy really works on a lot of things that we have to do. And if you need it, go to it. But it doesn't work on alcoholism, from my experience, because for therapy to work, it requires the truth. And you know, do the math. It's we are pretty far from the truth. If you're like I was when I got here, I had no idea what the truth was, went to a meditation retreat up in Montecito, California, and at that meditation retreat, I had a moment of clarity where I wanted to hang myself. I know that's not what you go to a meditation retreat for. It's certainly, if you do, keep the receipt. But I went there and I went out onto the grounds after having a moment of an astonishing experience, and I'm not going to go into because I don't have enough time, but I had a guided meditation, and then after that she said, go out on the grounds for the next 5 hours and think about your life. And I thought, oh, great, you know, why don't you just give me a shotgun with a mouthpiece on it? And because my life is going nowhere. I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die of this. I'm sick, and I'm just fed up. I'm completely full of despair. And while I was sitting out on the grounds of this place, I felt inside, it was a feeling that sounded like a voice, but it wasn't a voice, and it said, you are everything that you're afraid of, and I still love you. And I felt loved for like 30 seconds. I felt completely filled with love, and I didn't know where that came from. I thought I was losing my mind. And I left that retreat that night or the next morning, and I went home, and I haven't had a drink since then. And that was the 11th of June of 1981. And I didn't come here through a rehab. I got sober the old-fashioned way at work, sitting at my desk going, damn, what's that noise, you know, and looking around, and I had auditory hallucinations. I had, you know, I remember driving. I was living in Anaheim at the time, which is certainly the city you can't underestimate, and I was driving up to Santa Monica to work at Santa Monica College, and if you were ever in one of my classes or I helped you in the bookstore, my apologies right now. I was driving up one morning and a seagull flew by my car and I had to pull over and cry. Which, when you work on a loading dock with truck drivers, they want to know where you are. You can't tell them that, you know. I just had to pull over because I just felt weepy after the seagull flew by, and, you know. But I did. And I just felt terrible, and I didn't know what was happening to me. One day I forgot how to walk at work. I was sitting on a planter for about a half an hour trying to think, I don't know how to walk anymore. I forgot how to walk. I was actually watching people walking by just to see if I could mimic that motion as they go by for a long time until I finally got the guts to stand up and try it, you know. And it was a mess. And then I get a call about the fourth day after I've been going through hearing Steely Dan playing on my broken stereo in my car that had been out for like 5 years. It was out except for the album Asia. That was playing loud and clear in my head in the car. And my sister-in-law got out of a detox, and her husband had died of alcoholism. And she asked if she needed a ride to an AA meeting on a Sunday night, and she was getting out that Sunday, and she said that the AA people had come into the detox, and they had told her that maybe she should go to a meeting right when she gets out so she doesn't get used to not going to meetings, because she said they told her that meetings would help her stay sober. And so she wanted a ride because she was getting out that day. She said, will you take me to a meeting? I said, sure. So I went and got her. She had the address of the meeting, and I drove her for 20 minutes to this meeting. And in that 20 minutes, she 12-stepped me, and she had 22 days of sobriety. And she passed a message on to me. I don't know how she did it. She didn't lecture me. She didn't tell me about the big book. She didn't talk to me about what Bob really meant. She talked to me about how she felt getting when she was in this detox, and how she related to the AA people that came in, because she said they seemed to talk about themselves for no other reason than to be helpful. And there was no sense of anybody being paid or being gifted. They were just there and gave up their night or afternoon to come to the detox and talk. And she said, and I looked at her, and she looked different from when I knew her. I'd seen her 2 months before, and she looked like a different person. Her eyes were clear. Her face was different. Her whole demeanor was different. And I didn't realize till later that was her. That was a sober version of this woman who had had such a she had a terrible run with AA. She had a daughter, and she was widowed at 25, 24. And so I took her to the meeting, pulled up in front. I've got the imaginary gnats that kind of hover at your peripheral vision, and nobody else seems to see them, and you turn to look at them, and they're gone. And so you go back to what you're doing, and they're back again. You know, it's like waiting. And so all you can do is brush them away, which on a receiving dock in a bookstore, when you're sitting there waiting for the truck driver to get the bill of lading out and you're brushing away imaginary gnats, you get looks, but you know, you can kind of go with it, act like you're flipping back your hair, you know. And I was sitting there brushing away the imaginary gnats. She said, why don't you come into the meeting with me? And I said, because I'm not alcoholic, you know. I stopped. She said, that's okay, you don't have to be alcoholic. This is an open meeting, and it's a speaker meeting, and visitors are welcome. And since you quit drinking this week, maybe you'll hear something that'll help you. And that got through all my filters. I mean, that statement got through every filter I had up. Maybe you'll hear something that'll help you since you quit drinking this week. And I parked the car, you know, geez, and go in, standing in there, it's these incessantly happy hyper-caffeinated dog park full of people. Just everybody's shaking hands and sniffing around, and they were just happy, happy, shiny, happy people, and it was just awful. And the guys kept walking up and going, "Are you new?" And they'd hand me their card, you know, and they were all can-do spirit. I hate can-do spirit. And I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be with Debbie, because they kept telling how they got there. You know, I 12-stepped a guy 6 months sober. I met him at the Tuesday night book study, and I gave him my card. Unfortunately, I don't even have a card. I gave him my number. I didn't have a card then. And he called me the next day and said, "I need to talk to somebody. I need to get sober." You know, and so I ran home and got my cape, you know, and went off to save this guy. I went and got to Denny's, you know, and we're sitting there at Denny's, his name was Radcliffe, and he's still sober today, but he's Radcliffe's sweating, and I'm trying to get the utensils on my side of the table as he's telling me what happened to him. You know, he was drunk on Sunday, and the police came, and then the SWAT team showed up, and he was yelling like he had a weapon, and he came out of a blackout, and the guy had a boot on his head with a shotgun up against his head and cocked it and said, "If you move, I'm going to shoot you." And it was very hard for me to say, "Debbie brought me to AA." Because I just said, "How'd you get here?" And he said, "Well," he told me that story. I thought, "Oh, great, great," you know. But we talked, and the thing that turned me around with this call was I completely botched it. It was really, I had nothing I could help him with. I just, you know, was sitting there with him, and he said, "You know, I've written letters to my guru in New York, and I can't stop drinking, and I don't know what to do, and I just feel sick. I've been drinking for years, and the SWAT team incident and everything." He said, "But I don't know if I'm ready for AA." And that made me go, "Wow, because I know you're ready for AA," you know? And getting back to my first meeting, I had shoulder-length hair. I had hair back then. I had a nice mustache, and I had, you know, I was in my deerstalker hat, my Sherlock Holmes hat that I used to fancy wearing, my tweed jacket with the elbow patches that I bought at the thrift store on Main Street in Santa Monica, and I was wearing my sunglasses because occasionally there are flashes of brightness in AA meetings that you can't deny. And so I had my shades on. I'm rocking back and forth in the back of the meeting, collecting cards from people, thinking, "I got to get out of here. These people are crazy." And then we went out for coffee afterward because the abuse of kindness just wasn't enough at the meeting. And then I took Debbie home, and then I went home, and I didn't drink for a week. Because AA meets on Sunday, so I was going to go back the next Sunday. And I didn't go to a meeting all week, and then, sure enough, I'm starting to feel that, you know, everybody is closing in, and it's not me. And I went to the meeting the next Sunday, and they made me a greeter, which is like, I was like the guy at the door at the slumber room in the mortuary, you know. "Hi, welcome to AA. You know, run. These people are crazy." You know, I was just so unenthusiastic about it. But I stayed again, and I went home. And it didn't occur to me for a few months that the reason I stayed, because I didn't know why I kept coming back to AA, it wasn't the coffee. With all apologies to the coffee guys here, they make a mean pot of coffee here. But that meeting was, it was dreadful. It's like I was strained through a wicker chair. And yet, I drank it willingly, and what happened at that meeting and those meetings in the early days was that I realized something that I didn't realize it in real time, which you won't. And if you're new, I'm glad you're here, A, and I hope you understand that you don't have to experience anything you hear from a podium in real time. You will experience it, and it will surprise you, and it will delight you after it pisses you off. But I came out of... I realized that the first few meetings I went to, I felt completely safe in that meeting sitting amongst people I didn't even know. There were probably 300 people the Sunday meeting that I was going to. I knew none of them. And yet I felt safe, oddly safe in there. And I didn't drink for another week. And I wound up I heard Keith Carpenter, who had been a secretary of this meeting for in the 1960s, I think. And Keith spoke down there. And he had to drive from the west end of the San Fernando Valley to Tustin, which is where the Sunday night meeting was, which is about a two-hour drive. And Keith talked, and people kept telling me, you know, first I heard Chuck Chamberlain. They forced me to go up and thank him. And for my generosity, all I got was a kiss from Chuck, which I think is where I caught alcoholism, but that's a whole other evening. But then I heard Keith, and Keith was up there, and they said, go thank him. And I said, well, you have to thank him every week? And she said, he sacrifices night to come down here and talk to you. The least you can do is go up and say thank you. So I, okay, I get it. You know, it was explained to me by nice people why we did that. So I went up to thank him, and I was the last guy in line, of course, and he stood there and talked to me for about 10 minutes. Now, this guy had a two-hour drive ahead of him, and I was the last mope in line, and I was not looking like I was looking for answers, but Keith said, you know, I go to him, where do you work? And I told him at Santa Monica, and he said, my home group is probably 10 minutes away from where you work. Why don't you come there on Wednesday night? Here's my phone number. Here's the address. Come to the university synagogue, and I'll look for you. And I'll tell you something, if Keith had not taken that 10 minutes to talk to me, I don't know if I would have stayed. I don't know. But that guy had, he knew what he had to do, and he did it. And these things don't come quickly to us a lot of the time. We ignore a lot of it. And sometimes, you know, we hear around here, don't go out before the miracle happens. You know, you hear that cliche all the time. The one that's the second worst one is, we'll love you until you can love yourself. I want you, if you're thinking that, to know that loving yourself is not your problem. I'm sure you've spent many a night loving yourself. We will teach you to love other people until you realize that you have love in your own, in yourself, for yourself. But Keith got me to come here, and I got into the group. I got a sponsor because people wouldn't shut up about getting a sponsor. You know how that goes. It's like, you got a sponsor yet, Charlie? I'm like, no, I don't have a sponsor yet. Well, you better get one. I will tell it. Let me just quickly jump ahead, then I'll come back. I've been in this group, I've been sober for 40 years. I've been in this group for 40 years at various addresses during various stages of my life. My life has, because of the direction of kind people and the example of kind people in this group and in AA in general, because I was told to go to more meetings than my home group. I was told to get out once a week and go to a meeting that isn't even part of my home group. Get to know how people do it out there. Taste the world of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of it you'll hate, and some of it you'll go, that's pretty cool. But then you'll always come back to your home group and go, this is the best. This is where I can look at people and tell them what a schmuck I am. I mean, I remember one night coming to the Saturday night meeting, I thought I was going to die inside. I was going through a divorce. I had two little children. I was losing my kids to their mother, who was kind of off base. And I went to the Saturday night meeting, and it happened to be the night there were about seven ex-secretaries there of the Pacific Group, and Sharon was at the door, and she looked at me and said, ooh, boy, I'd like to be on a flight with you tonight. And I said, why is that? And she said, because if anybody tried to hijack the plane, you'd kill all of them yourself. Because I don't have a poker face when I'm mad. You just know I'm going to get up on the tower with a high-powered rifle in my head. And so she Sharon said, let's go for a walk. And she took me by the arm, and we walked all the way around that little Santa Monica neighborhood where they moved the meeting to, I think it was a women's center or something in Santa Monica. We walked around the block, and she just talked and listened to me. And she had been through the same experience with the same emotions and the same feeling that if she didn't do something about it, she would do something that most people don't have to worry about. She would drink. And I knew that if I didn't do something more serious about it, that I would drink too. And that's the line in here. Everybody, we all have emotions. We all have the same emotions. You hear people talk about, oh, I've got alcoholic emotions. Well, okay, but they're not like they're a different emotion. Alcoholics' emotions are different in that the intensity is usually inappropriate for the situation. The timing is usually bad, and the duration, well, I've hated him since elementary school, and I'll always be. But we have the same emotions as everybody else, but the thing that separates me from anybody else out there in the world and the way I feel about my life and myself and my fellows and my God is the fact that if I don't reckon with what is wrong inside of me, that I will drink again. And when I drink again, all bets are, I don't know what's going to happen to me. And I don't want to find out because I've seen too many other people do it. I've sponsored guys who've gone out. And I love the guys I sponsor. And it just breaks my heart. And anybody here who's ever sponsored a person knows how painful it is to watch them first back away and then go out. And it kills me. And but not enough to join them. I just have to redouble my efforts and try to be nicer than I feel most of the time. And when I got to that first Pacific group meeting, it was a Thursday. The second meeting was a Thursday. No, it was. I'm sorry. A woman named Alice was sitting next to me, and Alice was this little black lady, and she was having flashbacks to Vietnam, and she'd never been to Vietnam. And Alice sat, she was ferocious, and she was sitting next to me, and she said, "How long are you sober?" And I said, 40 days, and that ticked her off because she had 30. And she said, "You got a sponsor?" And I said, "No, I don't." And she said, she came, like right up to my face, "You better get you one." I said, "Yeah, I'll get me one, Alice." And she said, "You go to meetings? How many meetings you go to?" I said, "God, what is wrong with this woman?" I said, I don't know. I don't know where the meetings are for this group. You know, I just came tonight because someone told me you would be here tonight." And she said, "You got something to write on?" Well, I had a check deposit slip, which was unlikely to be used anytime soon. And I gave her that, and she took a rapidograph pen that had like a needle point. And she said, "Where do you work?" And I told her. And she said, she wrote the directions to the Pacific Group meetings Monday through Sunday from the driveway of where I worked. Just turn left at the driveway on Friday and make a left turn and then make another left turn on 20th Street. She had it written down in little letters on this sheet. And I carried that in my wallet for months afterward till I had to throw it away. It was falling apart. But then the next Thursday night, I go to the meeting and the crowd starts to part. And here's Alice. "You got a sponsor yet?" I said, "No." She goes, "You better get you one." Stomped off. I thought, God, there's like rabid animals around here. And Friday night was the men's stag, so I didn't have to worry about Alice. And then Saturday night, same thing. Then Sunday night, Ohio Street, there's Alice. You know, it's like, oh, God, somebody hide me. It's Alice. And she kept running up, grilling me on a sponsor. So I, you know, I was thinking, I don't need a sponsor. I'm smart. I've got a journalism degree and in a closet somewhere at home. But I was driving to work, and I got rear-ended on the 405. Right where it goes to the 10. And I was on my way to work. I was late. Some guy behind me clobbered me from behind. I'd stopped for the car that stopped in front of me, and I got sandwiched in between two cars. I'm 45, 50 days sober. I get out of the car. My eyes are spinning in their sockets because neither of the drivers spoke English, and I couldn't communicate anything with them. And I know I'm going to be in trouble, and I don't have any money to pay for this. And this AA crap doesn't work, and the cars are slowing. You know how they slow down? They don't have to. They just want to look at you, you know? And they're slowly crawling by, and I look, and in one car, there's Alice driving home. As she drove by, and I got a sponsor that night. Bill McDee, who was my sponsor for 26 years, I love that guy. I love him. And I got Bob R. as a sponsor about 15 years ago, and my life has gotten progressively better. Like I said, I have two children who are not teenagers anymore. They don't look at me like a bounced check. You know how they look at you when you come into the house and say, "Hi, how was your day?" "Fine." You know, I'm in my 50s at this point. It's like, I don't need this crap. I'm ready to die. I don't need to hear this abuse, you know. And I married a wonderful woman in the program, and she was their stepmother for a long time, and we split up about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And it was hard, and it blew up the whole family, and yet everybody survived. And my children have their own apartments, and I adore them, and we have a good life together, you know. And I've learned, I always find myself recommitting to AA to do more if I can. I'm kind of out of the way now, but I try to be active up in my area. And I'll tell you a story, what connects me to this group and people in this group, and I'll make it quick. When I had my kids, when I was, I was awarded custody of my kids full-time when they were about 5 and 6 years old. And so they went to an elementary school right by my house. And so I'd get up in the morning and I would make lunch for them, you know. And my father used to get up every morning and make lunch for me when I was a little kid. When I was from about the 7th grade to about the 10th grade. We didn't have much money at all. We didn't have any. I couldn't afford to take money to school and buy lunch. So he would make my lunch. And he put together a sandwich and he put chips in the bag. And if he had cookies, he put cookies in there, a piece of fruit or something, and write my name on it, you know, in his distinctive handwriting, even though he never graduated from elementary school. And he put it by the door and he went off to work. And I would get up and I would grab that lunch and I'd surly little punk and walk off to school. And as I got past the property line, I just take that lunch and throw it in the trash can and keep walking, because cool kids don't carry their lunch in a bag. They buy it, you know. And I don't need one more thing to identify me as a loser. I don't need one more thing. And when I'd get home, my dad would come home from work and he'd be whistling, walking up the walkway, and I would feel angry because I thought he should have been able to do more. And it kept me that far from my father my whole life. And what happened was, you know, when he died, I couldn't make amends to him because I was still drinking, but later on I did. And then, emboldened by the amends I made to my mother, I went to her and I talked to her about it. I said, you know, Dad used to make lunch for me every morning. And I would take it to school and drop it in the trash can every morning for years. And I never ate one of those lunches. And I just feel sad because I never got to thank him for that. And she said, well, I know you did. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, your dad told me that you were throwing your lunch away. And I said, well, how did he know? And she said, well, every 6 months or so, he'd say, how was that bologna sandwich today? And I'd say, it was great. And it was peanut butter. He'd say, was that apple ripe? Because it looked like it had a bruise on it. I would say, it was great. And it was an orange that he put in that day. And he never asked more than once, twice, every 6 months or so. But he knew I was throwing it away. And I looked at my mom and I said, if he knew I was throwing it away every day, why did he keep making it? And I think when you become a parent, you understand that a little better. But I got it from the look on her face. And that was that he loved me. I always thought he was disappointed in me. I always thought that he had judged me because I wasn't an athlete and I wasn't a warrior and I didn't go in the Marine Corps and I knew all that stuff. I thought he was judging me, and he wasn't. When I made amends to him, I realized he loved me. He adored me. I was his only surviving child. My mom had 4 kids and they all died except for me. And I took that as a sense of self-pity. Why me? Why do I? I don't even want to be alive. I don't want to be here. And she looked at me, and I knew, I understood what love is, because I understood what it is in Alcoholics Anonymous, because people got here early tonight. You know, from the secretary, who has an important part in my life through my whole sobriety, to the people who are here just right now in the meeting, and the people on Zoom, everybody's got something better to do, right? Everybody's got something better to do, but they came here. They keep track of the people getting into the meeting and being vaccinated. We wear masks because we care about each other. People came here and set up the taping table. They set up the podium. They set up the backdrop. Everybody's busy in this group trying to be of service. And that's what love is. It's a dry-eyed, unsentimental feeling of usefulness toward our fellows. And I was taught that by men and women in this group. In this group, many of whom are gone now. In fact, most of the old school gray line of people I knew when I got here are gone. And I miss them. But it's my responsibility to be like them. And so Patrick S. came up to me one night and said, do you make lunches for your kids? And I said, you bet I do. I put a sandwich in, and I put a piece of fruit in, and cookies, and a fruit roll-up, because that's very modern. And and I roll up the bag, and I write their name on it. And he goes, do you put a napkin in? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you fold it in quarters like a triangle? And I said, yeah. He goes, I do too. And so every morning, for about three years after that, when I made lunch for my kids, I'd fold the napkin and I'd say, good morning, Patrick. I'd drop it in the bag and I felt connected to somebody else. And I have to do that every day of my life. And for that, I get a sense of connection to a power that's way bigger than I am. And it's way bigger than you are. And it has a sense of humor. And I can only see it in you. I can't see it in myself. And it always wants to come out to play. And I'm glad that you have me here tonight. Thank you.